the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, happy Monday. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, on Sunday, we were treated to a... Actually, I didn't watch it, but I saw clips of it later on, and, you know, you can find it on the Internet and all that kind of stuff. But we were treated to a criminal. A criminal trying to justify his crimes, and in a rather pathetic fashion, in fact, not even, you know, like fully answering questions on Meet the Republicans on NBC Sunday morning. On their show, Meet the Press. They had on, I guess it was Chuck Todd was interviewing him, wasn't it? Let me just, you know, put this in context. This is a story that, according to the New York Times, Elizabeth Warren tells from back in 2009. Larry Summers leaned back in his chair and offered me some advice. He teed it up this way. I had a choice. I could be an insider or I could be an outsider. Outsiders can say whatever they want, but people on the inside don't listen to them. Insiders, however, get lots of access and a chance to push their ideas. People, powerful people, listen to what they have to say. But insiders also understand one unbreakable rule. They don't criticize other insiders. Just let that sink in for a minute. This is why, in my opinion, Bill Clinton didn't prosecute, but didn't even criticize Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush for breaking numerous laws. In fact, he issued pardons. Well, actually, it was George Herbert Walker Bush who issued the pardons for the Bush administration. We've got a really serious problem here in this country. I mean, you go back 1920 to 23, right? Warren Harding came into office in the election of 1920. He was sworn in March of 1921. At the tail end of a progressive and World War I era, essentially. And his slogans were less government in business, more business in government. In other words, deregulate and privatize. And cut taxes. And he did all three of those things when he came into office. He slashed government regulatory agencies. He outsourced a lot of government functions. And he cut the tax rate on millionaires and billionaires in today's dollars, millionaires and billionaires. Back then it would be worth, you know, people worth a million or 5 million or 10 million, which would be, you know, a billion in today's dollars. He cut their tax rate from 95% on their later earned money. I mean, obviously the first 5, 10, 15, 20, 30,000 in today's dollars, first $100,000, $200,000, much lower tax rate. But he cut that top tax rate from 94% down to 25%. Now, as part of his deregulation, he basically, you know, started ignoring what was going on with regard to government oil. And following World War I, we decided we needed an oil supply, a reliable oil supply, and a natural gas supply. So they started storing this stuff in a rock formation called Teapot Dome. And Teapot Dome is in Wyoming and California. This is the federal government. They decided to stash oil in Teapot Dome. And Warren Harding put his Secretary of the Interior, Albert Fall, in charge of this. Albert Fall then took a, shall we say, bribe? Well, actually, a court convicted him of bribery, so I think you could say bribe. To give a no-bid contract to an oil company that you know, was in on this thing. I'm looking through the Wikipedia page, but I don't see the name of the oil company. Oh, here it is. Mammoth Oil, a subsidiary of Sinclair Oil, and the Pan American Petroleum and Transport Company. No bidding. Okay, so Albert Fall lost his job, and he tarnished the Harding presidency. And to this day, Teapot Dome, you know exactly what people are talking about. Okay, here's a more modern version of this. 17 of those, this from the District Sentinel. This is an article by Sam Sachs and Sam, I forget his name now. Anyhow, they don't put the author's names up at the top, so when I print it out, I can't tell you. But anyway, the article, 17 of those 56 House Democrats, they're talking about the Cromnibus and how J.P. Morgan wrote a piece of the legislation. I mean, this isn't just no-bid contracts on an oil dome. This is writing legislation that will make trillions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars of profit for the banks. 17 of the 56 House Democrats who voted for this bill were among party congresspeople to receive the 20 largest donations from J.P. Diamond's bank during the last election cycle. Seven of those lawmakers changing their votes from yes to no would have killed the bill. Of those 17 beneficiaries of J.P. Morgan's largesse, 11 were also among the House Democrats who received the 20 largest donations from Citigroup during the 2014 election cycle. J.P. Morgan and Citigroup gave a combined $420,000 to the aforementioned 29 representatives, these are Democrats, through individual donations of political action committees. Over 75% of them voted for the Cromnibus. Representative Joseph Crowley, Democrat from New York, the congressman who received the most from both too-big-to-fail firms, combined and individually, and the fifth highest-ranking Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives, was given $65,800. Now, if you're a member of Congress, $65,000 is a hell of a lot of money. And that vote that Joe Crowley made in exchange for that $56,000, well, I'm sure he would not characterize it that way, but it certainly looks that way. That vote that he gave to the bank is going to make them insanely rich. But back to my original question about Dick Cheney, because, you know, I see these two things as two pieces of a whole. And I'd love to get your thoughts on what we can do about this. David Atkins writes, why are torturers being given balance in the press? He says these enhanced interrogation techniques, these EITs, as they like to call them, include rape, threatening family members with rape and death, suspension from ceilings and walls for days on end, forcing prisoners to soil themselves in diapers, various forms of psychological torture, including sleep and sensory deprivation. In many cases, these people had done nothing wrong and had no information. Now, then he goes on to say, you know, cutting the hands off thieves works wonders to reduce thief, but we don't do that. A moral person doesn't do that. This stuff is obvious, he writes, and yet the TV shows and newspaper stories are full of balance being given to the pro-torture side. Journalists don't always give balance to an argument if the other side is deemed irrelevant or depraved. No one's rushing to ask Assad's torturers in Syria if their tactics are necessary to keep terrorists in check. No one's asking North Korean guards if their treatment of their people is okay because other countries are worse. No one's rushing to counterbalance the accounts of Holocaust victims with the justifications of Nazi guards. It simply isn't done. So why in the world are the torturers who subjected innocent people to anal feedings and dungeon ceiling hangings given the courtesy of balance in the press? In a decent moral universe, torturers don't get the benefit of explaining themselves to the press any more than serial killers do, except potentially out of morbid curiosity, writes David Atkins. I agree. So why is this happening? And why are we not dealing with these scandals that Elizabeth Warren is pointing out? Hang on just a second. I'll give you my short answer.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The answer is because this is all being done by insiders. And the people interviewing them, whether it's Barbara Walters and David Koch or what's his name on Meet the Press, they're insiders. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Tom, whatever means necessary of torture is all right as long as it saves at least one American life.
Tom, that is respectfully A, one of the most immoral things I've ever heard, and B, one of the most stupid. Would you like me to go through why?
Go ahead.
Okay. It's immoral because what you're saying is that we're on the same level as them. They are barbaric, so we're going to become barbaric. That is not the principle on which this country was founded, and it's not the principle upon which any moral person or nation operates itself. It's stupid because
the principle upon which this country will survive and the American way of life will continue.
Only if you want the American way of life to be hell on earth. This country was founded on the principle that we don't torture.
On earth.
George Washington ordered that there be no torture of the soldiers that were taken as prisoners of war during the Revolutionary War. And as a result of that, the Hessians, the mercenaries, and the British soldiers turned themselves in like there was no tomorrow. Dwight Eisenhower ordered no torture of prisoners of war in Germany. As a result of that, Germans surrendered to us rather than fighting us. It works to our advantage, number one. And number two, and I said it was stupid, number two, if you read any of the literature, any good, solid scientific literature or even pop literature on torture, what you find is that 24-hour scenario that was played by Kevin What's-His-Name back on TV is a lie. When people are tortured, they tell you what you want to hear, not what is true. They will tell you what is true if you establish a rapport with them.
It's verified, then it's true.
No, it's not true, Tom. The people telling you that are lying to you.
They verify these things, and then they come back, and if the guy is lying, they continue.
Right. Tom, the people who are telling you that works are lying to you. Dick Cheney is lying to you.
He's not lying to me.
He is lying to you. He's trying to keep himself out of jail.
CIA. I trust the American government. I trust the CIA, whether Obama is the president or Hillary Clinton is the president or George W. Bush is the president. I trust the government and I trust the CIA. And
you know,
the average American should not be concerned about such things. The average American should take his family to Disneyland and Disney World and so on and so forth and let the government do what it's paid to do.
Okay, so like the good Germans, we should ignore the train cars going by. We should ignore the horrors being done in our name by our government, and we should just go to the party.
We should do whatever it takes to preserve the American way of life.
Okay, what it takes, Tom, is to behave humanely and to do appropriate intelligence work. Talk to
those who behave humanely will be given humane treatment. Those who crash planes into buildings
are dead.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're not understanding my point, Tom. Al Libby, for example, one of the nastiest guys that we arrested, when the FBI interrogated him, they got all kinds of really good and useful information. But he wouldn't say Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11. So George Bush sent him to to Egypt. The Egyptians tortured him. He said, oh yeah, it was Saddam Hussein. And George Bush took that to the UN. 20 minutes past the hour. Let me be very clear about one thing. The reason why torture exists. The reason why, down through the years and down through history, governments have used torture is very simple and very straightforward. Torture helps you to build a case to do what you want to do. It does not help in finding the truth. I know a lot of you have watched a lot of cop shows. The old 24 show with a ticking time bomb and was it Kevin Spacey or something. What was his? Kiefer Sutherland. That's right. Donald Sutherland's son. It's a lie. It's not how it works. You know, I've seen enough cop shows, you know, where the cop sticks a knife in the bad guy's leg or punches him hard enough. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, okay, I'll tell you. It's over at fourth. You know, occasionally. But not for anything high stakes. And real torture, the kind of torture that we were doing, the kind of torture that lasts day after day after day, week after week after week, month after month, and in the case of the people in Guantanamo now, year after year after year, real torture provides the answers that the torturer wants, not necessarily the truthful answers. but the answers the torturer wants. If you look at the case of the two highest profile, highest Al-Qaeda members who were directly involved with 9/11, Al-Libi and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. These were the two guys who had the most information. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed actually planned 9/11. Al-Libi was involved in moving money around here and there and other things like this. If you look at the history of this, and this is, you know, when people call me up and they say, you know, torture works and just go ahead and do it in my name, I would say you have not read this Senate torture report. You've never actually talked to anybody who interrogates people for a living. Because if you had, if you ever talked to somebody who interrogates people for a living, you find out that the technique that you use, the most effective technique that you use to get information out of people, is building a relationship with them, finding out their core values and finding areas of commonality and core values. It doesn't take an enormous amount of time. So anyhow, with Al-Libi and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, what happened? We arrested them. We turned them over to the FBI. The FBI are professional interrogators. The CIA are not. As John Brennan pointed out last week, when the CIA was given this job 6 days after 9/11, they had never before run an interrogation center. They did not have trained interrogators. They had never, you know, run torture centers. They had never run interrogation centers. They didn't have any. They had to build them in countries outside the United States because they knew what they were doing was illegal, and they didn't want it to be inside the United States. They wanted to minimize the probability that they themselves would be prosecuted. So they did it in Poland and places like that. So anyhow, with Al-Libi and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the FBI interrogated them using just standard technique, you know, good cop, bad cop, yell at you, talk with you, bring you a sandwich, get to know you, talk about your family, talk about your values, talk, you know, building this rapport. And in just a few days, we got virtually all of the details on bin Laden and on the 9/11 and everything from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He gave it all to us. And Al-Libi, the same deal. He gave it all to us. You go back and listen to John Brennan's speech last week, which the media says he says was defending torture. It was not defending torture. He said, I can't tell you that the order, he said, people on whom enhanced interrogation techniques were used did provide us with information. Well, that's true. But they provided us with information before the enhanced interrogation techniques, a.k.a. torture, were used. So what happened? I had a conversation with Ray McGovern on Friday night about this, and I think you might find it very interesting. It should be up over it'll be on our website soon. Ray McGovern, a 30-year CIA veteran. He used to prepare the presidential daily briefings for the president. He'd been involved. He was a military officer. He in intelligence. I mean, this guy, his whole life was in the intelligence service. And he pointed out that when they arrested Al-Libi and when they arrested Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, they got good information from them. And they began acting on that, and that arguably led directly to the capture of Osama bin Laden. But in the midst of this, George Bush was trying to convince us all we needed to go to war in Iraq. And the American people were opposed to it, overwhelmingly. And so George Bush ordered Al-Libi to be sent to Egypt to be tortured. Because he wouldn't say, you know, yeah, Saddam Hussein had anything to do with this, because he didn't. Saddam Hussein was a Ba'athist. He was a secular Sunni Arab, and Osama bin Laden hated him. Osama bin Laden, after he got kicked out of Afghanistan, went back to Saudi Arabia, put together an army, and tried to invade Iraq to take down Saddam Hussein. These guys were mortal enemies. There's no way Saddam Hussein would allow even one Al-Qaeda guy in Iraq. But Bush needed somebody to say that Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda were working hand in hand. And therefore, you could tie Saddam Hussein to 9/11. He had nothing to do with 9/11. He had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. There had never been a suicide bombing in Iraq in its 7,000-year history. So they take Al-Libi over to Egypt and they torture him. And in order to get them to stop, and some of these torture techniques involve, like, you know, threatening to or raping your children in front of you, crushing one kid's testicles 7-year-old boy's testicles in front of his father. I mean, this is bizarre stuff. And Al Libby was like, okay, I give. Yeah, Saddam Hussein was involved. And George Bush took that information and reported it to us, reported it to the United Nations, and used that confession obtained under torture, which was a lie, to justify the war in Iraq. That's when torture works. When you know what you want someone to say. There's a reason why they tortured witches in Massachusetts in the late 1600s in the United States. Women. To get them confessed to being witches. The reason why they tortured people in ancient Europe. Either to get the information that King Henry wanted, or to scare the hell out of his political opponents. It's never to get the truth.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Now, this is not rocket science. We all know this, or at least anybody with any intelligence or who's ever looked into this knows this. So my question is, why are the torture advocates on television? Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. So, you know, one of the questions is, when did it become normal for us in the media, for those of us in the media, for the news, as it were, to start showing both sides of a story where one side of the story was the criminal himself presenting his case? And to do so not in a way like, well, okay, the criminal says he didn't do it, but rather, here's the criminal with his rationale. Maybe you should take this seriously. In my opinion, this started during the Reagan administration. I could be wrong, but it seems to me that the beginning of this whole process was Ollie North. Ollie North destroyed, you know, the Congress passed this amendment called the Boland Amendment, which made it a crime, a go-to-prison crime, for Ronald Reagan or anybody in his administration to ship weapons or use any kind of federal funds at all to ship weapons or any other type of material support to the Contras in Nicaragua, to the right-wing death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Guatemala. The Boland Amendment makes it very clear. You can't do that. Well, Ollie North went ahead and did it. He sold weapons of destruction, weapons of war, killing devices to Iran, because their military was mostly American-made. The Shah of Iran had bought it all. This was just a year or two after the Shah fell. He sold spare parts and weapons to Iran. Iran gave him money. He did not put that money on deposit with the United States Treasury. Instead, he took that money and he gave it to gun runners and said, here, smuggle these guns down to South America. The gun runners got the weapons down to Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, and swapped the guns for drugs, which were very cheap, brought the drugs back to the United States and sold them like crazy in the United States. And suddenly in the 80s, we had this crack epidemic. Ollie North went before Congress and said, yes, I did it. And I'm proud of it. I was serving my country. I was fighting communism. Now, it's not quite as compelling as I was fighting the guys who made people jump out of the 121st floor of the World Trade Center to their death. I mean, you know, fighting communism is more of an abstraction. There hadn't been a communist blowing up a building in the United States since God only knows who. You know, I wouldn't even say that the Weather Underground were communists. I mean, they were just whatever they were. But this was according to his sworn testimony. I mean, you know, he testified under oath before Congress and said that he was coordinating the illegal and covert sales of weapons to Nicaragua and then moving that money via weapons to Nicaragua. It was completely illegal. He was doing it through a business that was owned by Richard Secord, a retired Air Force Major General, in May of 1996. This is from Rotten.com. In May of 1996, Secord stuffed $200,000 in a Swiss bank account earmarked for tuition fees for Ollie's children. The previous year, Secord had handed Ollie thousands in cash. At trial, Oliver North had a hard time explaining how he'd managed to save up the $15,000 that he found in his closet, or the two separate cash payments for a $9,500 used car after visiting Secord, or the $4,300 in traveler's checks he had that he used to spend on gas, groceries, and other things for himself. And the jury found him guilty of two felonies, lying to Congress and shredding official documents. And then he went on TV, and he started portraying his side of the story. Well, I wasn't a bad guy. I was a patriot. And now he's on Fox, which is where no doubt Dick Cheney will be. Well, Dick Cheney is half the time, and half his family. We have normalized, and we haven't gone, well, I was going to say we haven't gone so far as having, you know, child rapists on telling their side of the story. But in a way, which is worse? You know, raping one child or killing 100,000 people? Well, they're both pretty awful. Or torturing people until they die. It's all pretty awful. And therefore, we don't put people on television. We don't give people a platform to justify crimes. Article 6 of the Constitution, the second sentence of Article 6 of the Constitution, says that treaties we sign are equal to the Constitution itself in terms of the law of the land. It's as if you had passed a law. When you sign a treaty, it's as if you passed a law. In Article 6, says this Constitution and the laws of the United States shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Now, we've signed a treaty against torture. It's the law of the land. Dick Cheney's a criminal, and he was put on television. I don't get it. Do you? Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Let me say first, I think I'll answer your question. I agree that the what was your question about when did it start?
Yeah.
It did start sort of with the Reagan administration, but I'm thinking when morality became a part of the political discussion and an argument or a piece in the political game, and the Republican Party, along with the moral majority, decided that they were the ones who owned morality. They were the ones who owned God and morality. They owned the Bible and morality. And I think that the worst part of this, other than the torture, I mean, the torture's bad, but the fact that there is an opportunity or there's some forum for making balance out of this, that now, what is torture? Now we don't know, you see, because torture itself is what Dick Cheney is saying. Well, no, it wasn't torture.
Right.
Okay, if that's not, what is?
Well, Scalia gave some examples, and in his examples, I have to find it. But in his example, all of his examples ended in death.
Well, yeah. Okay, so, but we have gone that far. I mean, we've gone to the point where if we think somebody is going to do you harm, you can wage war on them, which is what we did when we invaded Iraq.
Right. In Wilkerson, the 1878 case, Wilkerson versus Utah, outlawed torture. But then in Bays v. Reese, Chief Justice in 2008, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote, quote, the court has held that the Eighth Amendment forbids punishment of torture and all others in the same line of unnecessary cruelty, such, and that's the end of the quote from Wilkerson. And then he goes on to say in Bays, such as disemboweling, beheading, quartering, dissecting, and burning alive, all of which share the deliberate infliction of pain for the sake of pain. So he's... What John Roberts is doing is essentially redefining torture as something that results in death and is extremely painful along the way.
Okay, well, there are different levels of torture, and of course, why this is all a bunch of baloney is because, number one, as people have pointed out, we executed Japanese who tortured and did the same things, waterboarded our soldiers, and it's part of the things we did are part of what's in the Geneva Conventions to which we are signatories.
Right.
So by those standards, we have already acknowledged that those things that we did, we consider to be torture.
Right.
And now what this is a weird thing, is that this discussion that's in the media is kind of like an ad hoc a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing that's going on. Is that, oh, now we'll decide there's no decision and we don't know really what torture is and we didn't really know what we did, it may or may not be, but it's this watering down. And so now the next step has to be, and so that gives an opportunity for anybody, as we pointed out before, anybody can do anything to anybody and just say, well, you know, I've got a rationalization. And what that is that mentality, this psychology is the same psychology as a spouse beater, a child abuser, a sex offender. They all have good rationale.
Right, right.
And that's what we are.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's just, it's like the matter of severity. Where are we drawing the lines kind of thing? That's not even a conversation. I mean, we decided that a long time ago. Here's something, Paul. Let me add this real quickly. We're just out of time. If we, you know, torture is a domestic law. If we decide torture is right for us to do to Al Libby, then why is it not right for us to do to the guy who's been accused of burglary?
Exactly. That's where we're going.
So pretty soon, our police departments are going to behave the same way Brazil's police departments were when the U.S. was advising them. Pardon?
They already are. Our police departments are already doing that. That's what the grand jury stuff is all about.
Yeah.
And resulted in death, by the way.
Right, right. Although the court themselves is not torturing, like apparently Brazil's was. But, Paul, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Excuse me. The court itself in Brazil sanctioned police torture. Our courts are sanctioning police murder. And probably torture, too. And welcome back, Mark, in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Mark, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Hi, Tom. A couple of things. That caller from Arizona is not paying attention to his own Republican senators. John McCain was the most credible person on the other side, and he was on Face the Nation yesterday. And he, of course, has personally experienced what it's like to be tortured. This is not EIT. I refuse to use that kind of rationalization.
Right.
This is torture. The other thing is that people like that, this is my own opinion, of course, and feeling, generally are looking at those people, quote-unquote, being tortured, and that's okay. If it's a white person in their own community, then it's torture. If it's not, then obviously it's necessary. And the third thing is
that... Well, let me just add to that, Mark. We put parents in jail for beating their kids.
Right.
I mean, we don't condone torture in civilian life in the United States.
Well, of course not, because we know it damages people long term, and that's a separate case, of course. But you know, again, your point was very much correct earlier, where the FBI was doing interrogations and they were getting good information out of these people. And then as soon as they were tortured, they clammed up. If you have to waterboard somebody 183 times, you don't know what you're getting.
Right.
You have no idea what you're getting.
Right.
Except that your people who are doing this should be prosecuted in jail. And that goes right up to Cheney. You know, that man has absolutely no conscience. He's a sociopath.
I agree.
And the fact that he was on any show being interviewed, along with the rest of that crew, just shows that that media out of Washington has absolutely no credibility or integrity.
Well, it's exactly what Elizabeth Warren said Larry Summers told you. You're either an insider or an outsider, and if you're an insider, you don't criticize other insiders. And Chuck Todd is very much an insider and wants to remain that way. Morris in Long Beach. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Hey, Professor, yes, I was at the protest rally in Los Angeles this past Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
We walked from Pershing Square down to Union Station, and I just want to share with anyone, if you should go to one of these rallies, don't wear a suit and tie. That's how I roll. And when they took one look at me, they were rather suspicious of me. Either I was a preacher, which is not acceptable because there are a lot of gay people. They're alternative lifestyle people. And as you know, ministers have a problem with that sometimes. Or I was an attorney. And, of course, they're not jumping up and down for attorneys either. However, there was a lady who was in the audience whose son or nephew had been killed by the Long Beach police. So I let her read my deprivation of rights under the color of law, which is what all these protesters should be asking for.
Right.
She was so impressed with it. She went to the folks who were conducting the program, and they said, well, we're going to let them speak when we get to Union Square, a Union Station.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got to Union Station, they did let me speak, and I'm not mad at them because I did see instigators there, Professor. And there are people that are trying to make these protest march look violent
right.
and unruly, but they're not. And I'm telling you, this is not a color thing. Man, I'm like, where's the black people at? I mean, everybody was out. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So this thing is gonna grow. But it's called the deprivation of rights under the color law. This is what you want on the books. Basically, these are like rights protecting citizens, federal. But the laws that we have on states basically are militia kind of laws. But we want to go from militia kind of laws to this one here, 242 of the deprivation of rights under the color law. And that's not a salvation, but it's a starting point because we get something on the books that we hang our hat on.
Right. And you can get the libertarians on board by pointing out that it's restricting the power of government, Morris. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Ray in Albany, New York. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Well, one, a lot, so much, and so little time to talk about it, but I want to point out a couple of ironies, which I think that your other callers have. I think we think that Charles Graner and the crew, the guy went away to prison for the torture at Abu Ghraib, will be talking to their lawyers now about some sort of equal protection under the law. You know,
well, they were prosecuted under the UCMJ, not under civilian law.
It seems to be contradictory, but in terms of how this thing has become normalized, your discussions about how this stuff has become normalized really reminded me of Hannah Arendt and the banality of evil.
Yeah.
And her coverage of the Eichmann trial. And, I'm going to read from Wikipedia for you. He says, Eichmann's inability to think for himself was exemplified by his consistent use of stock phrases and self-invented cliches. And it just strikes me that, you know, Cheney and the rest of them are repeating the same things over and over again.
Yep.
And the cliches and the marginalization of human beings. And that's all I got to say.
Well, I guarantee you, Frank Luntz has told them, you know, repeat the lie often enough and make it a big enough lie and it will become the truth. I mean, we all learned that from Goebbels. Thank you, Ray. John in San Diego. Hey, John, what's up? John in San Diego? Let's try Joe in Illinois. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
They already covered about, but I want to talk to you about my buddy. He was in Vietnam, and he was in a pen, and he was tortured for 2 years. I worked with him for a while. He was a pure alcoholic. I mean, he used to down a whole fifth of vodka.
Wow.
And I really don't blame him for what he went through.
Yeah.
So you tell Dick Cheney he really doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah. Torture breaks people. Yeah, that's about all it does. It doesn't break them in a way that causes them to tell you the truth. It breaks them in a way that causes them to tell you whatever it is they think you want to hear. And it leaves them broken for the rest of their lives. Joe, excellent point. Thank you. Lee in Forestville, California. Hey, Lee.
Yeah, I've listened to a veteran. I'm a member of the Veterans for Peace, and we had a conference every spring we have a conference, and this last May, one of the veterans from the Monterey chapter spoke about being in the prisoner of war, and he was captured before John McCain, and that John McCain was brought in right after they quit torturing people. But it's one of the few good things that John McCain has done is be against torture. But he's also voted against every benefit since Bush was in office for veterans.
Right.
So I don't know how he calls himself a friend of the veterans. But I originally called about the campaign contributions that are so out of hand, especially with the $20 million going to the guy that's being proposed for the new head of Treasury. That we need to look at, see how Australia got publicly funded elections, because they've had that for quite some time. You only campaign for 90 days before the election, and everybody in Australia has to vote. It's the law. There would be no voter suppression.
Right.
So I think we need to start I like the second Bill of Rights. I wish we could promote that, and we could put together a bill of demands for publicly funded elections, and then start with making corporations responsible for their crimes by sending the CEOs and the board members to prison instead of just fining them, like the government takes a cut of every crime they commit.
Lee, I am with you. I think the vast majority of Americans are with you. Excellent list of points. Thank you. Becky in Los Angeles. Hey, Becky.
Hey, Tom. You know, the people most affected, most directly affected by our torture policies are our military members who might be captured or whatever. And it really irritates me, that's a mild word, when these chicken hawks like Cheney and Scalia, people who went out of their way to avoid being in the military, do things, take these actions and justify them. And, you know, they were never in the line of fire. And it really angers me that we're exposing our military to this kind of to the retribution of
by telling the world that chaining somebody in a cell until they freeze to death, or that rectally feeding somebody is not, you know, it's just essentially rape of a man, that this is not torture. What we're telling the world is, if you capture our soldiers, we will not prosecute you if you do this to them.
Absolutely, and the people who are justifying what we did are people who never even bothered to put themselves in harm's way.
Right, they're the chicken hawks. Yeah, I would love to have a sit-down, meaningful, honest conversation with Colin Powell about this. I have a feeling this is a guy who's just probably on a daily basis struggling with his conscience. Lawrence Wilkerson, his aide-de-camp, his deputy, his number two guy, has talked about this a number of times, how Colin Powell felt like he was lied to, he was blindsided, he was taken advantage of, he was exploited by the Bush administration, and yet he's a good soldier. You know, he's always been quiet about what happened. But apparently when he discovered that the information he was presenting at the UN was filled with holes, he got furious. On the other hand, I'm sure he's not without blame at all. It's like, you know. But the only way we find out is if we have a trial, Becky. We need to have a trial for these guys.
But we're all to blame, because we all just, and I'm not saying directly to blame, but we all just, how many people among us have soldiers in the fight?
Yeah.
You know, 1% massive, so we all forget it. You
no,
know?
It's, it's about 4% of Americans have a family member who's in the military. It depends on whose numbers you look at. It might be as high as 7 or 8%. But the number of Americans, the percentage of Americans in the military is around 1%. And it's a fairly cohesive 1%, because it's a volunteer force, you're right.
Exactly. But they're the ones that, you know, when I see a soldier, I always thank them for their service. Although the Vietnam person in me wants to say, you know, are you insane? What you're not protecting me, you know,
right.
But I feel bad for them and their family. So thanks, Tom, for letting me have my say.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Becky, for calling and saying it. Great talking with you. We'll be back. It is coming up on the top of the hour. And what are we going to do today? Oh, yeah. Brent's Gorup is going to be with us. He is a libertarian over at George Mason University. This should be interesting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And ecowine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Well, this is interesting. Rick in Canada tweets, if Tom Hartmann, I think TV helps normalize good, bad. Oh, no, that's not the one. Where'd it go? Here it is. Rick in Canada. Canada. If torture worked on Libby, then maybe it would have been fine for his brother Scooty. Scooter Libby. Please, someone ask Cheney. Yeah. Brent Skorup is on the line with us. He's a research fellow in the technology policy program at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. The website is Mercatus, M-E-R-C-A-T-U-S.org. Brent, am I mispronouncing any of that?
No, that's all right.
Okay. You wrote an op-ed titled Cops Scan Social Media to Help Assess Your Threat Rating. You and I are politically probably on opposite sides of the scale, but this may be something on which we can agree. Tell us about this.
Yeah, no, I think there is agreement, some on the left and some on the right, about the problem of over-criminalization generally. But so I wrote an op-ed on a similar trend, a similar symptom, and that is this police application that's being developed, and it's called Beware. It's developed by a company called Entrato, and they sell it to police departments, and this application crawls billions of commercial, public, all sorts of records, but also, you know, what a lot of people are worried about is it also crawls social media, your online comments, and purchases, recent purchases you've made, cars you own, and it assigns you through an algorithm, proprietary algorithm, and assigns individual people a threat rating. So I believe it's a 1 to 100 score, and it also makes a green, yellow, or red designation of what sort of threat you pose to police. I came about this just incidentally to other research I did and wrote an op-ed because there's a lot of troubling implications of this.
Yeah, there's a lot of troubling implications of this. I can understand if the local police department or the FBI or anybody else discovered that I, as a guy who's got nothing to do with the construction or farming industry, rented a truck and a bunch of 50-gallon drums and went out and bought, 500 or 1,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer and 40 gallons of diesel fuel the way that Tim McVeigh did.
Yeah.
I can understand that, and in fact, I would want the, you know, whatever police agencies keep track of those kind of sales, and I frankly suspect that they're not as well kept track of as they probably should be. I would want them to, at the very least, call me up and go, what the hell are you doing? And by the way, we've noticed what you're up to. On the other hand, what I post on Facebook, am I really going to go on Facebook and say, you know, I just bought 600 pounds of ammonium nitrate?
Right. I mean, it's not clear how relevant a lot of this is. I mean, you would certainly have errors along the way, especially, and like you said, I think most people would agree this makes sense in certain circumstances. The problem is this Beware system and other sorts of databases are being used in just routine enforcement. And in the op-ed, I talk about the police boast that they use this for code enforcement. So if they use the example of overgrown trees on a property, they can just look up the property owner, find their phone number, call them, and make them trim the trees. So, I mean, I'm not aware of any state laws limiting how police can use these sorts of data.
So wait a second. They would find out that your tree is hanging over your neighbor's yard because he complains about you on Facebook. I mean, what's the tie to social media here?
This isn't directly tied to social media, but okay. The Beware system uses social media, address information, phone numbers, and puts all this together into one package and shows the threat rating.
So what could I possibly do or say, or you, Brent, what could either one of us possibly do or say that would cause our federal government that is watching our Twitters, watching our Facebook accounts, you know, reading anything that we're writing on blogs and posts and whatnot, and knows our address and presumably is watching our house from Google Earth or something, or the military equivalent, what could cause them to put a red next to you or me?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, and that's something, you know, I didn't discover. I mean, I hope other journalists and scholars will look at this and civil rights groups to see what is going to be.
Is it going to a mosque?
Those sorts of things. I'm sorry?
Is it going to a mosque? I mean, we know in 1934, if you went to a synagogue in Germany, you put yourself at risk.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I think that could be considered relevant. And the issue is, we don't know. I mean, Entrato, the company who makes this, says, you know, we'll send default relevancies to the police, but it's up to the local department to determine what's relevant and what's not. And that makes oversight pretty difficult, especially since it's not even clear. I couldn't find any information on which departments are using this currently. There are federal grants going out to purchase these and similar systems. In the op-ed, I mentioned that the city of small city of Bellingham, Washington, turned down a purchase of Beware because local citizens got wind of it and found it scary. So they redirected the funds. So I would hope there would be some more publicity over these and you know, Beware and other databases that are just collecting indiscriminate amounts of information and allow pretty constant surveillance.
They use this program, police, you write, police used Beware. This is the name of this computer program that they're selling to, that a private for-profit company is selling to police departments. Police used Beware recently a fish concert in Colorado, checking up on concert goers based on car license plates. What the hell?
Yeah, no, that was the first piece where I came across this, and it raised red flags in my mind. I mean,
what about going to a fish concert makes you a potential terrorist?
Right. I mean, fish. I don't think fish fans are known for being particularly violent criminals. And it just.
And this was in Colorado, where you can't even say that they're illegally smoking dope.
Right. Right. Exactly. So I mean, there's all sorts of. I mean, it just. I think it shows that. I mean, no one is exempt from this sort of system.
So we find ourselves now in this situation. And let me bring this back around to the largest picture I can think of. Maybe you've got a larger one. We're talking with Brent Skorup, and Brent is with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, Mercatus, MERCATUS.org. If you watch Citizen Four, have you seen that movie, the new movie about Edward Snowden?
No, I haven't.
It's worth the watch. I don't know if it's still playing here in D.C. or not. For a while, it was at E Street in Georgetown. Now it's out in Georgetown, or out in the direction of Georgetown, or it was a week and a half ago when my wife and I went to see it. The point that he made, and we have just a minute here left, Brent.
Sure.
The point that he made in that movie, basically, is that now, since 9/11, all of the apparatus of a police state is in place in the United States. We haven't had a president who has pulled the trigger, who has said, okay, start using it. But in other countries, if this were to happen in Singapore or in China, you know, I made a comment in Singapore at a public venue about pressuring the government for education reform. And I went back to my hotel at the Mandarin, and the police had been there, and they had completely trashed my room.
Wow.
And the manager of the hotel was like, yeah, they do that sometimes. You must have offended somebody. This is how a police state works. How do we stop this?
Right. I mean, I would hope awareness would help some, and I think Beware and
is it time for some regulations? That word that you guys tend to hate.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think when it comes to surveillance and using police power, there needs to be restrictions on when that is used. I mean, police. I mean, like any of us can be reckless, and but when it comes to police, you know, being reckless has greater cost than an accountant being reckless.
Excellent point,
Brett. Restraints on this.
Brent, we're out of time, but thanks for dropping by. Brent Skorup, he's a research fellow at the Technology Policy Program at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, Mercatus.org. Thank Brett. Thanks, Brent.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts on the news, your thoughts on my thoughts, and all that kind of stuff right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michael in Imperial Beach, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, about your media political insider thought. The media political insiders, who I think are told not to ask tough questions, don't want to rock the boat with their billionaire bosses.
I can, Michael, let me just correct one thing, because I've been there.
Okay.
And, you know, not for a long period of time, but I've been there on the inside. And the message to insiders is don't rock the boat. The message is far more subtle than that. You interview somebody and you give them a hard time, as I did with the United States Senator when the bankruptcy bill was being debated in 2005 or six. And that senator made it very clear to me that senator would never again be on my program. Now, fortunately, I do a program that doesn't require senators coming on to make my program work. But that's not the case with Chuck Todd. If senators refuse to come on Meet the Press, Chuck would lose his job. And his job, no doubt, pays at least $4, $5, $6, $8 million a year. He's making a lot of money. And so that's how it works. It's really much more subtle than what you just described.
Okay, but I mean, Chuck Todd, compared to a billionaire, is nobody power-wise.
You're right.
I mean, you don't bite the hand that feeds you, and it will protect you in the future. And isn't Andrea Mitchell married to Alan Greenspan?
She is. That does not, that does not make her guilty of anything. I mean, you know, she might just be a great wife and good friend to her husband.
Of course, and I'll give you that, yeah. But, I mean, I just think that, you know, you can't stand up to your boss. I mean, man, $8 million compared to a billionaire, that's nothing, man. You know that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my point is that, you know, the congressman who got the most money from the banksters to vote for a deal that's going to make them billions was only paid $56,000. I mean, the best investment in the United States is buying a congressman. These congressmen if I was a prostitute, I'd be embarrassed by the analogy. They're giving it away.
I agree. All right, thanks, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot, Michael. It's always nice to hear from you. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. On Friday, you and a caller couldn't figure out the difference between President Clinton and Reagan, so I thought it would help out.
Okay.
Reagan cut taxes on millionaires, which caused huge deficits and debt. Clinton raised taxes on millionaires, which gave us huge surpluses. Reagan gave us a weak economy in every respect. Clinton gave us the largest economic expansion in history, 23 million jobs created, median income up 17% above inflation, 8 million people raised out of poverty, gave health care to 6 million kids and tried to give it to everyone, but the Republicans blocked it. Clinton also increased gas mileage requirements on vehicles, saving thousands of tons of pollution in the air.
And many lives.
What's that?
And many lives.
Right, right. He also raised the minimum wage and decreased pollution from coal plants. So I'd say Clinton's record proves he's a real progressive.
Yeah. Well, I'd say Clinton's record proves that he did many real progressive things. I think that there's a piece of Bill Clinton that's a real progressive, and I think there's a piece of Bill Clinton that's, you know, get along, go along, who's an insider. I think this distinction that Lawrence Summers made for Elizabeth Warren when she was first coming into Congress is probably the exact same distinction he made for Bill Clinton when he met with Bill Clinton, Jamie Rubin, and Alan Greenspan 2 weeks before Clinton was sworn in, which is, are you going to be an insider or an outsider? If you're going to be an outsider, nobody's going to pay attention to you, but you can say anything you want. If you're going to be an insider, you got to be careful and you got to never criticize other insiders. But, Paul, your points are brilliant. Thanks. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I see us as in this moment, kind of a precipitial moment, if there's such a word, you know, kind of standing on the precipice, standing on the edge. This moment in time on a whole bunch of different fronts. We're in this moment on time on the economic front, where you've got two really quite, well, arguably more than two, quite significant forces economically in the United States. You've got the globalists, the internationalists, principally the transnational corporations in other countries that want us to sign all these free trade deals that open the United States up to other countries. Every developing country wants to be China when they grow up, right? They want to make all of America's stuff in their country and sell it to us. So you've got that. You've got the Republicans and conservatives in Congress and the billionaires who fund them who really don't think it's an appropriate role of government to make sure that the food you eat is safe, the water you drink isn't going to poison you, even if it's slowly over time with micro amounts of arsenic or benzene, who don't believe that your pharmaceuticals should be regulated and carefully controlled, who don't believe that the quality of the water in our rivers and streams is of that great consequence, who do believe that businessmen and women should be making all of these decisions. This is what Republicans mean when they say no small government, less regulation. Dirtier air, dirtier water, poisoned food, unreliable drugs. Let's just go back to the way it was, you know, before the Food and Drug Act was passed and before the USDA came into being. And before the EPA was brought about. When the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, when Lake Erie was completely dead. Let's just go back to that. It was much more profitable for the big companies. So you've got that political force. You've got the bankster political force saying, don't regulate us. We want to play with trillions, hundreds of trillions of dollars, and we want to do it with government backup. And then you've got a populist uprising in the United States on left and right. Ralph Nader wrote a brilliant book about this called Unstoppable, as I recall. Had a long conversation with Ralph on the air back 5-6 months ago when the book first came out. And it was 23 or 27 specific items, much like the conversation I just had with Brent, where, quote, far left people like me, people who just hold the positions that 75 to 90% of Americans hold, strengthen Social Security, give people job protections, bring back pensions, bring back the unions, clean up the air, clean up the water, invest in our infrastructure, let's go back to tariffs or at least a VAT tax to provide our exporters with protection for their industries and protect small businesses. Let's break up the big banks. Let's break up the big corporations. Let's enforce the Sherman Act. All that kind of stuff. You've got that versus, you know, the billionaire class that wants to run everything. And this is no small battle, because not only is this battle the outcome of this fight, this 34-year Reaganomics fight, not only is it going to determine the quality and nature of life in America, and it already is to a large extent. The middle class is shot. The middle class used to be, I mean, you know, union jobs used to represent a third of Americans. A third of Americans had union jobs. They had pensions, they had health care, they had guaranteed vacations. They had a mechanism by which they could challenge their employers, and if they did so, they could not be fired just for challenging their employers. A third of Americans. And one of the things we know about labor that I'm guessing the Koch brothers don't want written into the North Carolina curriculum that they got passed by law is that for every job that in the workplace for which a labor union sets the floor in terms of wages and benefits, there's another job in the private sector that has that same floor because the union creates the competitive environment or influences it. So, you know, our unionization in the United States has gone from over 30% under Reagan to under 10% now. In the private sector, it's under 8%. So what has happened? We've gone from two-thirds of America, three-quarters of America, being able to make a good living, a comfortable living, have the American dream. A little higher percentage of that for white America, a little lower percentage of that for black America, but still it's substantial. We've gone from that to only about a third of Americans being able to actually make a living, regardless of race. And again, it's skewed racially. Whites, it's easier. Blacks, it's harder. Other races fall into different, you know, similar categories along the spectrum. But here we are. Here we are with these really significant kind of battles for American soul. Whether it's the economic battle, whether it's the who are we battle. Are we a nation that feeds our children? 1 out of 5 American children goes to bed hungry at least once a year. 3 out of 5 American children live below the poverty level. Are we a country that feeds our children? Apparently not. Republicans just gutted, you know, just ripped another $1 billion out of food stamps. Are we a country that provides health care to our children? Apparently not. In over 20 of our states, Republican governors and Republican legislatures have refused to extend Medicaid so the children of low-wage working parents can get health care. Well, by refusing to extend it, they're refusing to give it to those children. And yet these people run around and say America's a Christian nation. Really? I recall Jesus saying, and I think it was in the Sermon on the Mount, words to the effect of, you know, if you offend a child, you might as well have a stone wrapped, you know, tied around your neck and be thrown into the ocean. I mean, that's how bad it gets. And yet that's the official Republican policy. That's Paul Ryan's policy. Do away with food stamps. Do away with WIC. Do away with all these programs. They just make people lazy, you know. Well, in a time when there's no jobs, how the hell are you supposed to find a job whether you're lazy or not? And why is it that when the job market gets strong, unemployment goes down? It's suddenly people aren't interested in being lazy anymore. They never were.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So we have essentially a battle for the heart and soul of America and the future of America. Stay tuned. It's talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Well, this is fascinating. Peace Train posting over at Democratic Underground a link out of ibtimes.com. The Kansas governor, Sam Brownback, you'll remember Sam Brownback is a big fan of Reaganomics. He was a senator. He was, I'm not sure what he was during the Reagan administration, but I believe he was in Congress, but I could be wrong. But he's a guy who thinks that Reaganomics is what it's all about. That's going to make it work. And he also happens to be governor of the state where the Koch brothers live. So what did he do? He slashed taxes on rich people like the Koch brothers. Thinking, and in fact saying out loud, this is going to produce mind-boggling prosperity for Kansas. Instead, it ran Kansas right into the ditch. Kansas, like every other state except Vermont, Vermont's the only state in the union that doesn't have a constitution requiring an annual balanced budget. Kansas has to balance their budget. And so Brownback is now desperately looking for money to replace the money that is lost because the Koch brothers are paying lower taxes in Kansas. And not just the Koch brothers, all the other rich people there too. So his proposal, this is from the International Business Times, quote, Brownback's proposal slashed the state's required pension contribution by $40 million to balance the state budget. He's going after KPERS, the Kansas Public Employees Retirement System. The article goes on to point out Brownback follows Republican Governor Chris Christie in coupling large tax cuts and credits to billionaires and corporations, I added that part, with cuts to actuarially required pension payments. In New Jersey, Christie slashed required pension payments while signing legislation expanding tax credits to corporations and doling out a record number of amount of corporate tax subsidies. Many of those subsidies have flowed to firms whose executives have made campaign contributions to Republican political organizations. Surprise, surprise. How corrupt has this country become? And what can we do about it? Well, in my opinion, what we can do about it is get money out of politics. Step one, move to amend.org, which, by the way, used to be part of Humboldt County Democracy Group, whatever, and now is its own standalone 501c4. They just registered, which is a good thing. I mean, they're moving forward and growing. Move to amend.org. It's amazing stuff. Russell in Hickory Hills, California. Hey, Russell, Illinois, what's up?
Hi, yeah, I'd like to know your opinion on two things. First, Tom Coburn has put a hold on the, I don't know if you heard this, on the funding of the veterans coming back from the Iraq and Afghanistan that are committing suicide. He says it costs 3 days of the Iraq war. We can't afford this. And the other thing is, I heard you're about the 20 states that don't have Medicare.
Right.
These people get off their butt and get the Republicans out. Then you'll see a difference in those 20 states.
Yep.
The first one, what do you think about Coburn holding up the money for veterans that are committing suicide.
Yeah, well, let me answer the second one first. If, for example, Allison Lundergan Grimes had run a strong, aggressive campaign on how Mitch McConnell was wanted to take away health care from Kentuckians, if she had run, you know, with President Obama and with Democrats instead of against them, she would have won. She would have beat him. And Mary Landrieu could have won in Washington State, and Kay Hagan could have won in North Carolina. I mean, right down the list. So I wouldn't say, you know, I'm not willing to blame just the Republicans. The Democrats are failing to pull a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren, which would win them like nobody's business. Second, with regard to Tom Coburn, I don't know the details of that, Russell, so I can't speak to it. Can you give me specifics?
That he says that we can't fund the suicide, you know, the people coming back that are committing suicide, like 22 a day. It's too expensive.
Right. I believe you that something like that got said by, and Tom Coburn saying something like that makes sense. But I personally don't have the information, so I can't verify it, so I can't really discuss it. I'll look around. Russell, thank you for the call. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Well, he did actually put a block on that, which I found just extremely amazing.
Coburn on the suicide bill?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things. It's so much crap they throw at us that even the people that's aware miss things like that.
Yeah.
Actually, the bill was named after parents of a guy who came back who committed suicide, and they personally made a begging plea. These are conservative Texans.
Oh, the Clay Hunt Veterans Suicide Prevention Act.
Correct.
And this is the one that Tom Coburn put a hold on.
He put a hold on.
Amazing.
Put a hold on. Absolutely amazing that these people keep getting voted in.
Yeah.
You know, we hold our Republicans to a standard, and today I'm going to hold our Democrats to an even higher standard. I am so furious at Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders right now. You have no idea. We've learned a valuable civics lesson over the past 6 years. And I'm glad that caller came in and talked about Coburn. One senator could put anything on hold and shut the whole thing down.
No, Carl, there's an exception to that. There's an exception to that. The exception is budget bills, which is what's called reconciliation, and budget bills can't be filibustered.
And they went through reconciliation and got that done.
Yeah, because anything that involves a direct appropriation of funds, money, is considered
right.
Reconciliation by definition, and it can't be filibustered.
Okay. So they couldn't filibuster this at all.
No, because it involved appropriating funds. If it had been, you know, a law saying roll back Obamacare, or if it had been a law saying, you know, put people in jail for spitting on the sidewalk, no problem.
Okay.
But when you're talking about funding the government, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. That's an up or down vote.
I hope like hell that you are right about that, because if these two senators could have filibustered this thing and they didn't, then I don't care to hear from you anymore. I don't care to hear from any of your tough talk.
Yeah.
And I
agree with you, Carl. I mean, this bill passed the Senate by 56 votes, which means if it could have been filibustered, it could have been stopped. And Ted Cruz wanted to filibuster it. I'm sure Bernie or Elizabeth Sanders wanted to filibuster it. Somebody called on Friday last week and asked Bernie if he would. And as I recall, his answer was something to the effect of, this is not the kind of bill you can filibuster. And I'm pretty sure that's why.
Okay. Something that you missed on with Dick Cheney and with some of the CIA guys that's coming out and talking right now. Dick Cheney has contradicted his boss, George W. Bush, and pretty much threw him up under the bus because he said, no, we knew.
Right.
That guy knew. And he referred to President Bush as that guy. It was very flippant. It was very unpresidential or unvice presidential. Like,
well, it tells you who was in charge for 8 years.
Yeah, I mean, he really threw George W. Bush on under the bus by saying, yeah, we knew about it and we signed off. What George Bush has been saying over the past 5 or 6 years that you know, we didn't know about it and we were misled.
Yeah.
And I think as of this Sunday after that interview, George W. Bush's legacy has been cemented. I mean, he is Hoover, Johnson and Nixon. Nixon with the scandals, Johnson with the war, and Hoover with the economy crash. I mean, this is who he is, and this is his legacy. I don't care how many nice, sweet interviews he do with anyone, Candy or those guys.
Oh, Dick Cheney is far worse than any of those guys. Dick Cheney, I mean, Lyndon Johnson went to his grave with massive regrets. I could play you tapes from his tapes where even during the war, he's going, what the hell are we doing? He was tortured by the war. You know, Richard Nixon, I think, frankly, Richard Nixon was tortured by the war, too, although he was a little more of a sociopath and a little less affected by it. And he was basically, he'd been a crook his whole entire life. Who was the third you mentioned?
Hoover.
Oh, Hoover. Yeah. And Hoover was just a useful idiot. I mean, he had been in office. He was sworn in March and the market crashed in October. He'd been in March in office for 6 months. He didn't know what he was doing.
Usually, yeah. does that not describe George W. Bush?
Yes. Yeah. Idiot. I think George W. Bush was the useful idiot and Dick Cheney was the Darth Vader.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And this is their legacy, man. And they can't get away with it. I don't care how hard they try. And I love the ideas you come up with about President Obama need to just pardon them. And I bring that to my daughter, and she said, why would he pardon them? I said, because from then on out, they would have to explain in the history books why President Obama pardoned Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, because they were involved in potential criminal acts while they were in the presidency. You have a good day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carl. Yeah, it would be like tattooing the scarlet letter on their forehead or something. Carl, thank you for the call. Dave in Northampton. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, it's good to talk to you. I just had a couple of things that I wanted to discuss with you and get your ideas on them. I mean, the only thing that I can think of that would excuse Chuck Todd's performance was that maybe he was thinking, you know, there's a difference between an interview and a debate. And maybe he felt that he was just there to get Dick Cheney to tell his story, and, you know, as awful as it was.
No, here's the two things that were animating it, Dave. Number one, Chuck Todd's first job is to get as many people to watch Meet the Press as possible, because it's a moneymaker. It's all about the money. It's all about the commercials. It's not about the news. And so in order to get as many people to watch as possible, he had to get Dick Cheney in. Number two, Chuck Todd wants to remain a Washington insider. The first rule of being an insider is you never question or criticize other insiders. You only question or criticize the outsiders. Ted Cruz, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders right now are considered outsiders. Dick Cheney's an insider. So you don't criticize him. You don't make life uncomfortable for him. That's what's going on. Dave, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm telling you, the thing that you need to learn about this city that I didn't even know until I moved here 4 years ago is it's not left or right. It's inside and outside. Welcome back. Glenn in Byron, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Tom, you know, on all these calls, as far as the torture goes, you know, I understand that it's different when the president or former president comes right out and says they had legal, you know, right to do that according to their administration or whatever. But I've got to tell you something, 1979-1980, I was down at Fort Benning, Georgia, and they taught us how to torture them. This isn't something new.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very specific. And, you know, it's not like, you know, maybe a corporal would come along and tell you when you were in training. We had a training module where we were marched out into an area. It was different than a lot of training modules, and there weren't a lot of people around. And they do it under the guise of how you were going to be treated as a POW.
Right.
And how to respect officers and so on. But then they talk about torture you might be subjected to, but then they go way into it. You know, all you need to know is they might use electrical shock to your testicles. They don't have to tell you the four most efficient ways to do that.
Mm.
They went into great detail about waterboarding. Now, this is being taught as a module at Fort Benning, or it was when I was in.
What year?
I'm sure it was before and after I was in.
Now, Fort Benning, isn't that associated with the School of the Americas?
Yes.
And, well, you know, I mean, we were teaching these techniques to the people from the South American death squads. We were training people at Fort Benning from the military junta in Brazil and in Chile. We were sending people from up to Fort Benning and back down to Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala during the war in the 80s. So, I mean, there's been a lot of calls to shut down the School of the Americas.
Well, sure, and they were separate, and we were kept separate from them.
Yeah.
But I was being trained. They were training infantry, airborne, and airborne rangers there. And
how to survive torture.
Well, it was how to survive, what to expect, and how to survive. But then they went very specifically into the best ways to do all this stuff. There is no doubt whatsoever they're teaching us how to torture people.
Right. Under the guise of teaching you how to survive torture.
At some point, you know, eyes would start darting around.
Wow.
You know, from the guys in the squad that was being trained, and we'd be looking at each other like, what is this?
Right.
And so, you know, it's not anything new. It's just somebody finally stood up and said, yeah, we're doing it.
Yeah.
Said, yes, we're doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, that's very, very unfortunate. This is should not be part of military training. Glenn, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing the story with us. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Byron, Michigan. We'll be back. From the weapons of mass deception, Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria Jones on the line with us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world?
Well, we're hearing now that three people, including the gunman, have been killed during the end of the Sydney hostage siege in a cafe.
And
yes.
In Australia.
In Australia.
Right. Yes.
The hostage taker was Iranian-born man Haron Monis, a man in his 50s with an extensive criminal record who called himself Sheikh Haron,
although senior Muslim officials in the Sydney Muslim community say he had absolutely no religious qualifications whatsoever.
Wow. By the way, just a FYI, your cell phone audio is so bad and so muffled that we've picked up your Skype audio. So
okay, very good.
Yeah,
very good.
So although you can keep the phone up there just in case, you know, one
just
falls.
Just in case it comes back.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've read that this might just be a lone wolf guy. Is there any bigger story here? Or is this just say something awful happened in Sydney, Australia?
At the moment, it says something awful happened in Sydney, Australia. We don't know that anything bigger happened. We don't know whether he was a lone wolf or a crazy person.
Right, right.
We don't know at this point.
Okay. What else is there?
The National Labor Relations Board is moving to grant unions sweeping new powers to organize workers, and business leaders are ticked off.
I wonder why.
Yeah, they say it would be an early Christmas present for big labor.
Is this card check by any chance?
What it is a couple of things. One is speedier union elections.
Right.
2 years after a nearly identical rule was struck down in federal court. And the other one is that employees should be allowed to use company email systems for union business.
I would be reluctant to use a company email system for union business just because presumably the company can read the company emails. I mean, if Kim Jong-un can read Sony's emails.
Exactly. You would think. Now, businesses are also bracing for another decision that they're very worried about. This could help cement a previous finding. The McDonald's is a so-called joint employer. Now, such a designation could hold the company responsible for the labor violations at its independent franchisees, potentially sending shockwaves through every industry operating under a franchise model.
Now, the rationale presumably for this is that if you are a franchisee, you buy, you know, you buy, most people don't even understand how this works, but say you want to become a McDonald's franchisee, you buy the property, you build the building, you put, you know, a couple $1 million of your own money into it, you build the McDonald's, and then you pay McDonald's for a license to use their name, and then you also buy most of your raw materials either from McDonald's or from suppliers that McDonald's certifies, authorizes, and takes a skims some off the top. And then McDonald's, in exchange for you doing all that, does national advertising to bring people into your store.
Right.
So there is a very, very hand-in-glove, more than symbiotic relationship between the franchisor, McDonald's, and the franchisee, Joe Blow, who just built the McDonald's at the corner of 3rd and Main and is running it.
Exactly. So if they do find it's a joint employer, that could really, really impact McDonald's.
So McDonald's and other franchisors have been able to successfully hide from labor laws by claiming we're not actually employing those people. Joe Blow, the guy who owns the building,
yes,
who owns the franchise, he's the employer?
Yes, exactly. But if they're called joint employers, they would be presumably jointly responsible for labor violations at the independent franchisees.
Right. Well, it makes perfect sense.
You would think it would. Now, there's another NLRB decision that they're on the lookout for, whether college athletes can organize and also how much authority the board has over religious institutions. And I don't have any more details over that one than that.
Well, that could get very interesting if they decide that religious institutions can be unionized. Expect to hear heads exploding at Jerry Falwell Liberty University.
I'm thinking.
Yep.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said plaintively on the Senate floor this morning, I want to go home. I bought a new home there, as everyone knows. I sold my place in Searchlight. I have a home in the greater Las Vegas area. I'd like to be able to see the home. I have not slept in it. We bought it in May.
Wow.
But then he went on to say, we're going to have to be here until we finish our work, whether that is Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. So everyone should understand, you can't be leaving.
Okay, so let me get this straight. The Cromnibus bill, the one that gives Jamie Dimon, you know, his billion-dollar birthday gift, that actually passed the Senate, or was that a procedural vote setting up the passage?
That has passed. So, in fact, okay, it's no longer a Cromnibus. It's an omnibus.
Right, okay. So that has passed and gone to the president for his signature.
Yes.
What else do they have to do?
Oh, well, they have the tax extenders to do. So that's extending tax breaks until the end of this year. They have the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act. They also have...
These are both things that benefit big corporations, by and large, and rich people.
Right. But they also have 23 of President Obama's most controversial nominees.
Ah.
To confirm.
And this is the one where Ted Cruz opened the door for this by inserting a 30-hour procrastination moment.
Right. Accidentally. He and Mike Lee didn't realize, apparently, that they were doing this procedurally. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid jumped on it like white on rice. Mm. And the Republicans in the Senate, I don't know if they're madder at Harry Reid than they are at Ted Cruz. Yes, I do. They're madder at Ted Cruz than they are at Harry Reid.
Yeah, and not for being malicious, but for being stupid.
For being stupid. So we are very likely to get a Surgeon General in the form of Dr. Vivek Murthy, a Harvard and Yale trained physician who's been repeatedly blocked by groups led by the NRA.
Remarkable. Well, you know, a silver lining, I suppose. The Cromnibus, by the way, it could not be filibustered because it was an appropriations bill and a reconciliation. Am I correct about that, Victoria?
That's my understanding.
That's your understanding, too. Okay, thank you very much. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 5 minutes past the hour, and, coming up on 6 minutes past the hour. And our old friend Brad Friedman, friend of the show, bradblog.com is his site, is on the line with us, founder and publisher of the Brad Blog, Brad Friedman, bradblog.com. Brad, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be here, Tom. How are you, sir?
I am well, thank you. Great to have you with us. I hope you are well as well.
Thank you. I am.
And everybody in your family or in your life. The last time we talked, there were two things that were kind of up in the air, and I just wanted to close the loop on them. Mm-hmm. The first was we talked about how down in Maine, or out over in Maine, I guess up in Maine from where I am, and I guess from where you are, too, there was an obscure little election that seemed to be the Republicans seemed to have won via ballot stuffing. And then the other is in Oregon, the last I had heard, they still didn't know if the GMO must be labeled ballot initiative had been passed or not, because they were doing the first ever hand recount when it always they had done machine recounts in the past. Do I have those two things right?
Yes, almost right. Yeah, we can start in Maine very quickly. And these are, still from the November 4th elections that we are still following as everyone else has largely moved on. These elections still matter to a lot of people, obviously. Out in Maine, really interesting case, really interesting mystery, that I'm happy to report has now been solved. It's actually a rather important election. It was for the Maine State Senate. On election night, the Democrat had won this race in Senate District 25 by just a few votes. So the Republican asked for a recount, which is understandable. Senate District 25 is actually made up of about seven different little towns. One of them, one of the smallest, is a town called Long Island. And this mystery really was, perfect for murder, she wrote, to
right.
be frank.
This town is on an island, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it actually is an island, yeah. And what they found when they went back to count to recount those ballots in Long Island, Long Island is the only town among those seven that actually hand counts their paper ballots on election night. Everyone else uses computers to count those paper ballots. Well, as it turns out, in Long Island, all of a sudden, 21 more votes showed up when they did the recount than existed on election night when they counted 21 more ballots.
And all for Republicans.
All for the Republican in the race. And it didn't make sense because there was 171 ballots counted by hand on election night. 171 people signed in to the voter manifest. No one knew where these 21 ballots came from. Nonetheless, they were all for the Republican. They resulted in flipping that election from the Democrat to the Republican. The Democrat then objected, said, they didn't know where these 21 ballots came from. And so there was a special conference, a special committee set up in the state Senate. Even though they went ahead and provisionally seated the Republican until they figured all of this out, they put that Republican in place. Well, it turns out we now have an answer to what happened in Maine. It wasn't a ballot stuffing case, it appears, but rather after 5 hours of testimony in the state Senate, they did what they should have done in the first place, was they pulled the ballots back out and they counted them again. And what do you know? There was only 171 ballots there after all. There were not 21 extra ballots. Apparently, the Secretary of State miscounted on the hand count, moved one stack to another, and actually double counted 21 of those ballots.
Wow.
So
intentionally or accidentally?
Well, no one knows for sure at this point. Let's say it was an accident.
The Secretary of State is a Republican.
The Secretary of State is actually a Democrat, which is more amazing that the Secretary of State actually certified these results that no one could explain.
Okay.
The good news, by the way, is that hand counting works.
Yes.
Long Island was the only town of all those seven that actually hand counted their paper ballots. They were the only town of those seven that, as we now learn, had a perfect count on election night. All of the other towns, which use computers, had to adjust their totals once they bothered to hand count them in the recount.
Wow. Shades of what happened to Don Siegelman in November of 2002.
Yes, where something suddenly changes. The difference here is that because this was all done publicly, unlike with Don Siegelman, where they were supposedly counted in secret, we were able to oversee the entire process.
Well, and in so Don Siegelman's case, as soon as he pointed out that he went to bed the governor and he woke up having the governorship stolen because in one district, one Republican guy had discovered, 13,000 extra votes on his computer?
Secretly, in the middle of the night in one of the counties. Yeah.
Yeah. Don Siegelman started screaming about election fraud, and boom, several months later, he's in prison.
Yep.
Anyway, and in fact, Don Siegelman today is his hearing. Let us not forget. In fact, I think it started at noon, as I recall.
It's a big day for Don Siegelman.
Yeah, I haven't gotten an update on it yet, but if you go over to free-don.org, you can probably learn about it. I'm going to try and find out at the break at the bottom of the hour. But back to you, Brett. So that's what happened in Maine. What happened in Oregon, or what's going on in Oregon?
So in Maine, the Republican resigned. The Democrat will now be sworn in shortly. There's some good news there. Back in Oregon, however, you had this huge initiative for GMOs, for GMO labeling of genetically modified food. And you recall that on November 4th in Oregon, they passed a lot of progressive. It was, actually unlike the rest of the country, it went very progressive up in Oregon, except for this measure, Measure 92, which appeared to have lost on election night. In the weeks that followed, as they canvassed and did everything else, and looked at the ballots, there was some 13,000 that were not counted, that were rejected for signature problems on the ballots, because they do all mail-in, all vote-by-mail in
right.
Oregon.
Right. If I can really quickly explain how that works, because I lived in Oregon, you get two envelopes along with your ballot. You fill out your ballot. You don't put your name on your ballot. It's a secret ballot. You put the ballot inside an envelope, and on that first envelope, there's a line for you to autograph to put your name on it, and you sign it. And then you put that inside another envelope that you mail it in. So they know from the, and I may have the envelopes backwards here, but basically they know from the envelope that you, this registered voter of this name, actually did vote. And then they know from the ballot how you voted without knowing that it was necessarily you. Am I making sense?
Yeah, okay. That's exactly right. And I know that a lot of folks in Oregon love their all vote-by-mail elections. I'm no fan because, in fact, one of the easiest ways to defraud the system is actually by vote-by-mail ballot, by absentee ballot.
Right, which has happened in the UK.
Right. And it's happened, by the way, in Oregon. That said, they love it. It leads to big turnout and everything else, so they like it. But I'm no fan. Nonetheless, 13,000 of those ballots were rejected in this GMO race, which was decided by 812 votes out of 1.5 million cast. So you've got, just 812 vote margin, 13,000 votes rejected because local officials said, those signatures don't look like they match to me.
Or people forgot to sign it. Right.
Or they forgot to sign them. The good news is they put out the names for the first time. They put out the names of these 13,000 people and gave them 2 weeks to come in and cure the signature problems. That cured about 8,500 ballots, but there are still 4,600 rejected ballots in this race decided by 800 votes, and the proponents for this GMO measure wanted to have those 4,600 ballots put in because they say – voters are not told that their signature has to match a registration on file that may have been put in years and years ago.
Right, and people's signatures change over time. So we're running out of time here, Brad. So they have not yet decided the race in Oregon?
They have now decided it. The court said, yes, it will be irreparably harmed if these 4,600 ballots aren't counted, and yet law doesn't allow them to be counted. They're thrown out. The GMO folks are conceding this race, unfortunately.
Okay, so the 5,000 ballots wasn't enough to flip it.
It would have been enough had they counted it, but they didn't allow it to be counted.
Okay. Brad Friedman, publisher of the Brad Blog. Thank you. Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Remarkable. Brad does the best reporting on election stuff in the country. Bradblog.com, 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jesse watching Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, let me get this out front. Thanks for having that basic income for all program Friday. That was very good.
My pleasure.
I'm looking forward to seeing that video.
Yeah.
Miss Warren, that lady, God bless her. I think she could be the future Mrs. Washington. I think people should pay attention to what she said more than her personality as the lady or the Messiah. What got her on the map was saying, we help you create it. And now she says, who do we work for? This is Thomas Paine stuff here.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
When you're talking about insider versus outsider, you add this up, you connect the dots to the Civil War with the people who believe in slavery versus the people who didn't. This is what we have now. People believe in money, the money god, profit, versus people who believe in democracy.
Right.
And so how can we avoid it? You started out saying, what do we do with a person who accepts $65,000versus people who, if they deal drugs or work in the war industry or work in the financial industry? They don't like doing it, but they got to do it.
Yeah.
So this is where I connect what you the program Friday, a basic income for all. If people knew they had a basic income, they wouldn't be forced to do a lot of the things they don't want to do. So
I agree, although I don't think that applies to members of Congress.
It may be.
They're paid $185,000 a year.
Problem.
They have a basic income.
They said something Friday. They say, you asked the question, how can you fund this?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, we could tax, change the income tax, or we could tax the Wall Street. I'm going to bring in Bernie Sanders' 12-point plan here, and I'll end it with this. They could fund it using Thomas Paine. Stop giving the money to the people who abuse us with it. We could give it to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But the main, most important thing the word have to get to the people is that capitalism is unsustainable. So we're going to have to change.
Yeah.
So this is where it gets to, if people don't want to sell drugs, you don't want to build bombs, you don't want to steal people's homes, you give them a basic income. I'm 64. I see everybody out there marching against police brutality. They need to be marching against economic brutality.
Yep.
I would march on taking back the Federal Reserve. That would be the only thing I would march for. And the other thing would be the fund occupied credit union. So I know I took up some time, but it's hard to get through these days, Tom. Thanks for all you do.
Okay. Jesse, thanks for the call, and I think you're spot on all those things. Thanks so much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV down in Miami. We have a real serious challenge, and the thing that is so critical and that you need to start thinking about in terms of how you're organizing your brain and understanding things is this quote from Elizabeth Warren that Larry Summers told her when she was first elected. You got to choose. You're going to be an insider or an outsider. Very interesting stuff. 20 minutes past the hour. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Well, actually, 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. And it's an amazing situation we have in the United States right now, where our Congress is passing laws written by banks that will make banks billions of dollars in profits. And how much did they pay? The largest donation that they gave to one of the Democratic congressmen, the one who was the largest recipient of Citibank and J.P. Morgan's largesse in the last 12 months, the most they gave this guy was $56,000. Now, say they did that to 200 members of Congress. That's, 1.2 million bucks, I think, if I'm doing my math right. Invest $1 million, make $1 billion. Seems reasonable to me. But it shouldn't be that way. I mean, this should be against the law. You're not going to hear any mention of this at all on television. None. And the reason why is because where is that money going? It's going into television ads. Television, I mean, you know, television, they're loving the fact that this was a $3 billion a year election. 4 years ago, it was a $2 billion a year election. 8 years ago, it was a $1 billion election. Hey, every year, the radio and TV stations, particularly television, they make an extra $1 billion. They're loving it. By the way, over at the Naked Capitalism blog, I found this fascinating. A piece by, how do you pronounce Y-V-E-S? Eve, thank you. By Eve Smith, which is a pseudonym, by the way. But in any case, this piece by Eve Smith about whether or not the reason that the think about this. I think this is fascinating. What Congress just did, and it's on its way to the president for his signature, it may already be signed. What Congress just did with this continuing appropriation bill, this omnibus continuing resolution thing, what they did is they said, if you, Mr. Diamond, if you, Mr. Citibank, if you are, and Elizabeth Warren came out and said we should have broken up Citibank when we had a chance, and Bernie Sanders is proposing legislation now to break up Citibank. But what we said to them basically was, if you're making bets on bets on bets, if you're taking, you know, $1 billion worth of commodities and turning it into $1 trillion worth of bets, leveraging 1,000 to 1, so that every dollar you invest, you make $1,000 back when it goes up. And, you know, and the flip side is every dollar you lose, every dollar you invest, if it goes down, you lose $1,000. If that's the game you're playing on derivatives are bets that are based on something that has underlying value. There has to be something at the bottom of a derivative, right? The derivative is a home mortgage, or it's a car loan, or it's oil futures. And then people take bets on whether those oil futures are going to go up or down in value. And then people take bets on the bets, on whether those bets are going to pay off. And then people take bets. And each time it gets more leverage. So it grows like an upside down pyramid. And so you can end up on a couple $1 billion worth of, you know, $100 billion worth of oil derivatives. You can end up with, you know, $100 trillion in derivatives. So what Eve Smith is proposing, or asking, really asking the question in this post over at nakedcapitalism.com, is that the banksters have been gambling on oil derivatives. Let me just follow this for a second. The banksters have been gambling on oil derivatives. They've got hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars in these oil-based derivatives out there. Oil is a really hot market for commodity speculation. It has been ever since the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, ever since Phil Gramm, you know, allowed oil to be traded on dark markets. This something Phil Gramm did in 1999 or 2000, at the request of his wife's boss, Ken Lay, over at Enron. So if there's $1 trillion worth of oil-based derivatives out there, and the price of oil just went from $110, $115 a barrel down to $65 a barrel, there's $100 trillion worth of losses out there. As of tomorrow, the banks will be able to declare those losses and then go to the FDIC and say, please pay us back. Could it be? Now, I might not even be reading this article correctly. Eve writes, to unpack this for generalists, CLOs are collateralized loan obligations are used to sell highly leveraged loans, which are typically created when private equity companies take companies private. You know, well, it just goes through the whole thing. There's a lot of wonks talk on here, but that would probably lose a lot of people. But the point is that is it possible that instead of setting up the next bailout of the banks, that instead we just bailed out the banks? That they're already in trouble because of oil derivatives. And we just said, okay, fine. Take the money that, Hartman's got in his checking account, use that. Or whoever. I mean, you got money in there. You know, could that be going on? It actually makes a lot of sense to me. And it makes a lot of sense to me that would be the reason why some members of Congress would say, you know, I hate this, but I don't want to see the banks go down, so I'll do this. You know, it's a fig leaf, right? It's a rationalization. The reality is, you know, let's make sure Jamie Dimon doesn't lose any money. Pretty bizarre. We'll be back 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And once again, I make the point, the Supreme Court legalized all this. They legalized the gambling. They legalized the owning of politicians. It's the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program, and welcome back. Wow. A lot on the table, a lot to talk about today. The state of the union, the state of affairs, the state of our democracy, of our republic, where we're going with this, how we get there, how we got here. Tammy in the Dalles, Oregon. Hey, Tammy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I would like your opinion on something. Why isn't lobbying called bribery?
Well, it used to be.
I mean, really?
In large part because the Supreme Court has asserted that not only talking, I mean, lobbying started out in the law, arguably, I mean, this is the local lore. The Willard Hotel is this fancy schmancy hotel that's right across the street from the White House. And it's a block from our TV studios. And I walk by it almost every day. And they've got a really fancy restaurant, the Café du Parc, and all this stuff for nice breakfasts and whatnot. And the lobby of the Willard is one of two places that have been claimed to be the place where Abraham Lincoln used to go during the Civil War, and war profiteers, gun manufacturers, whatever, would come there and they would try to pitch their stuff to him. And members of Congress would go there and they would meet and talk and sometimes change money. So, you know, the idea of lobbying, of trying to assert influence, is old. The idea of adding money to that was made a crime in 1907 by the Teddy Roosevelt administration with a law called the Tillman Act, which made it a felony, a federal felony, for not only a corporation, but the senior officials, stockholders, and board of directors of a corporation could all go to jail if the corporation gave money to a federal candidate for election, to a federally elected person. That was blown up in 2010 by Citizens United. The Tillman Act was struck down. This from our wonderful Supreme Court people like, you know, Sam Alito and John Roberts and Mr. Thomas, who all say, oh, we believe in stare decisis. We're, you know, we believe in established law, say Clarence Thomas. So, and we're not going to change the law. Well, they did, and they do hugely. So that's why it's not called bribery.
So that, but it was that recent. I mean,
yeah, well, okay. It really started in 76. In 76, in a case called Buckley versus Vallejo, there was a rich guy, I think whose name was Buckley, who wanted to run for political office, and he wanted to fund his own campaign, and the campaign laws did not allow that. They treated your own money as the same as anybody else's money. And the Supreme Court said, No, if you're a rich guy, you can put your own money in it. It doesn't violate campaign laws. Then the next year, they said the same thing is true of a corporation. A rich corporation can throw as much money as they want in or money. And then the big one was Citizens United, because that blew a hole in all the campaign spending laws. And then McCutcheon this year said, what was left intact of Citizens United by the Supreme Court was what are called aggregate limits. In aggregate, you could only buy a certain number of politicians. I guess it's sort of like the old, you know, ownership rules with regard to radio and TV stations. You can't have too much influence. It wouldn't be a good thing. And what McCutcheon says is there's basically no limit on the number of politicians you can buy if you've got enough money. So that's how we got here.
That really is awful. I mean, yeah. I just don't understand why this cromnibus has turned into an omnibus and how any party could stand behind it. There is no benefit to the middle class or the working class, which everybody's always touting that they want to protect and take care of. This whole reverse psychology, who knew it would be so easy to turn people against themselves?
Yeah.
Really.
What astonishes me, Tammy, is that without exception, the really onerous, stinky, evil stuff in this bill, you know, the backstop the bank stuff, the steel workers' pension stuff, it has been entirely and exclusively promoted by Republicans.
Yeah.
And the cut the EPA, the cut the NLB, you know, all these things. And there is some positive stuff in this bill. There's a fair amount of positive stuff in this bill, increasing funding to deal with Ebola in Africa, for example, increasing funding to deal with research on AIDS in the United States. Those were all put in by Democrats. And how the American PA, the media is not reporting it that way, which is tragic. And B, how the American people can fail to understand that. Well, they fail to understand that because our media doesn't talk about it. Right?
But, it doesn't. And that kind of, you know, I was listening to you earlier and I just had a little thought. A lot of my friends do not even know about Free Speech to Me TV or Democracy Now, or that they're channels on TV. So perhaps maybe they could put those channels for Dish and DirecTV out there a little more.
Yeah.
So
well, and please don't hesitate to tell your friends. It's word of mouth is just the most powerful form of advertising there is. So if we could all try to go viral, and whether it's Free Speech TV or whether it's the radio stations that we're on, if you're listening to WCPT in Chicago or KNTF in Milwaukee or the Mike in Madison, or there's a long list. I'll start offending people if I don't, that I forget. But in any case, let people know how you're listening, that you're listening.
And one more thing, if I may, I just want to give a plug for the Affordable Care Act. My situation is my husband recently retired, and so, of course, the pension gutting in this bill is terrifying. And without the Affordable Care Act, we would not have affordable health care for our family. And it is affordable. And you have to wade through the websites and read it and decide what's best for you.
Right.
But there are numerous plans out there that work. And fortunately, we live in Oregon, so we were given that option. And I would just encourage people to take the time to research and to go online and to get health insurance. It really wasn't that hard. It took a couple hours, but so what? We saved several $100 a year, at least $600 or $800 a month. I'm sorry. Yeah.
So a month.
Just a plug for Affordable Care Act.
That's marvelous. Tammy, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching on Free Speech TV on Dish Network, and much appreciate it. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Johnny. Hey, Tom. One of the many things I like about your program are these mini historical refreshers, because we forget so much over time, especially as we get older.
But welcome to my world, Tom.
Say again?
I said, welcome to my world. I sometimes think I've forgotten more than I ever knew. Anyhow, back to you.
Well, you know more in your one pinky than a lot of Republicans know collectively.
Well, that's not hard.
Sir?
I said that's not hard.
Yeah. Anyway, growing up in the 60s and 70s, under the threat of Vietnam constantly, and then being reminded in history class about all the wars that our country has had, Civil War, Spanish-American War, World Wars I and II, Korea, and on, I learned that we're a nation not of laws, but of war makers and law breakers.
Mm.
And that kind of cinched it for me when I was a young high school student and Richard Nixon was pardoned by incoming President Ford.
Right.
And what that does is that demoralizes the youth. It sends the wrong message. It reinforces the idea that the United States will do what it wants, when it wants, regardless of any laws that they make. They can break their own laws, but we have to abide by them.
Right.
So the worst possible thing that Barack Obama could do in regards to Dick Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld is to issue any pardon to them.
No, I'd say that's the second worst thing he could do.
Okay, it tells the people abroad, we are a nation of lawless people.
Right. I don't disagree with that point. However, I would say it's the second worst thing that he could do. The worst thing that he could do is nothing, and that's what's going to happen.
Well, he doesn't have to do nothing, Tom. He could do anything but pardon them.
I know, but he's not going to.
He's a bully pulpit to remind people directly or indirectly. And he's talented. He's a talented speaker. He could do it if he wants to.
But he's not going to, John.
More direct. He's got nothing to lose.
He's not going to. He's an insider. They are insiders. Insiders don't go after insiders. This is how it works in D.C. This is how it works in every state capital. This is how politics works in America. And probably not just America. Probably everywhere on earth. Political insiders are a club. It almost doesn't matter if they're Republicans or Democrats. They're insiders. And there's the insiders and the outsiders. The outsiders are all of us, and the talk show hosts like this, like me, who don't toe the party line and always say exactly what the party wants, and you know, reliably show up at the Christmas parties and et cetera, et cetera. And you know, there's, if you want insiders in the media, turn on network news. You'll find insiders rather than outsiders.
Tom?
Yeah, go for it.
Speaking of insiders, I have a starkly different memory of the Bill Clinton administration than that earlier call. I remember Bill Clinton as being one of the most friendly Republican type of presidents. He did the welfare, revising welfare as okay. The Republicans wanted. And all those jobs that they talk about, a lot of them were poorly low-wage jobs like in slaughtering chickens.
Yeah.
Lots of things. He pardoned lots of criminals. You know, liberals don't do that.
Well, I don't begrudge him pardoning the pardons that he did, although the Mark Rich pardon was kind of dicey. But that's, you know, that's every president does that, and the numbers were not unreasonable. My problem with Bill, you know, I think Bill Clinton was on net an okay president. He was, you know, he really was Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, you know, he and Dwight Eisenhower was a very good Republican. And or a very bad Democrat, one or the other. But times changed, and I'm just waiting. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens 2 years from now. Johnny, thanks for the call. Because either the American people are going to say, enough of the insiders already, we want an outsider, and Elizabeth Warren is an outsider, Hillary Clinton is an insider. Either we want an outsider, or, you know, maybe the insiders are going to flip. I don't know.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But somehow I doubt it. So it's good. We live in very interesting times. It's going to be interesting. Watch it. It's going to be fascinating to see how all this plays out. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave watching Free Speech TV in central Nebraska. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Something threw into my radar that I haven't heard you mention. But Illinois' governor, Pat Quinn, has got a bill on his desk, been passed by the House and the Senate, that makes it a felony to tape the police in the performance of their duty.
The Supreme Court has ruled that you cannot criminalize videotaping of the police.
Well,
how are they getting around that? I mean, there are some exceptions. You can't You can videotape the police in public. I don't know if you can in private or not, frankly, but, you know, what's the rationale? What are the caveats? What are the, I'm unfamiliar with this law. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, it's a little convoluted, but, you know, it's still there. It's, look it up. It's 1342.
Mm-hmm.
And they say quite specifically that, it will be considered a felony.
This is Illinois law.
Uh-huh.
Is there a HR or SB or something in front of the 1342?
I talked to their office, and the 1342 is the only number they said. I would assume it's HBO. His office is very receptive.
Yeah.
At 312-814-2121.
Okay. I'll have to look around on this, Dave, and see what I can learn. Thank you very much for the heads up. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
I just wanted to say, you know, I know on Friday you were talking about Nazism, and I think that the idea of American exceptionalism, which the Bush administration, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, and the whole lot of them came up with, is not very much different, because didn't the Nazis believe that they were so exceptional that they were superior to every all the races on the earth.
Yeah, but the Japanese think that about themselves. The Chinese think that about themselves.
They use this idea of American exceptionalism to define, what we would do in the case of torture. It's now okay to torture enemy combatants.
Well, now wait a second. Now we're conflating things, because the idea of American exceptionalism did not start with the Bush administration. It started with the George Washington administration. And then the idea that America had a grand destiny, you know, that started coming in really heavy during the Jefferson administration and went on steroids during the Andrew Jackson
administration.
American
exceptionalism being talked about, as a response to 9/11, and that we were.
Well, it was dragged back out, but it used to be manifest destiny. Remember that?
Right. And I think that idea is morally bankrupt, because when you claim that you're exceptional, you're saying that you're superior to all the other nations on the earth. And I don't believe that. And I think that's inherently un-American, really. And if they claim that, then that's part of our history. I think that's part of our history that should be changed.
Yeah. I agree. There's a dark side to exceptionalism, or nationalism would be another way to say it. It can also be something that brings people together as tribe, community, nation. You know, nationalism has a good side too, but the dark side of it is very potentially destructive. John, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Kurt in Los Angeles. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I want to talk about you're talking about the top of the hour about how we got to a place where talking about both sides of an issue when one is clearly a criminal act is somehow the norm now. But first, I want to let you know that Ted Cruz, between 2008 and 2012, he acquired over $1.5 million in loans and credit lines from both Citibank and Goldman Sachs. Now, according to Open Secrets,
he personally?
Yes. Not only did he acquire loans, but there were 1.25% loans plus prime. Okay.
What was the basis? Was this to buy a house or?
No, I mean, I have no idea, but on opensecrets.org, you can find, you know, just look up his name. All that money has now been paid back.
Right.
So in less than 4 years, this man managed to acquire $1.5 million in borrowed money from the banks who are now asking, or at least Citibank, asking or leading the charge to get, you know, a chance to get Dodd-Frank repealed. So I just want people to know where next time you hear that man talk, where his loyalty really lies.
Okay.
Back to your question at the top of the hour about how do we get to a place in our own media where trying to talk about both sides of the issue is the norm instead of, you know, reporting the truth and the facts and saying, hey, you're a criminal and we're going to investigate you and we're going to, make sure people know that you're not a good person. It sort of ties into what your previous caller was just talking about, how back in Nazi occupied Germany in the 1930s, part of the Nazi regime was a guy named Joseph Goebbels, and you mentioned his name earlier in the first hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they used propaganda for 6 years in the lead up to the invasion of Poland from 1933 to 1939. They used radio and propaganda to dehumanize an entire race of people to the point to where once the occupation or the invasion of Poland happened, it was like, oh, well,
yeah.
Oh, I guess they had it coming.
Yeah.
No big deal, you know. And so when you look at what's going on now to where you have people like Paul Rhine, he visited Auschwitz, okay? I sent him a documentary or it was on YouTube clip. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. He visited Auschwitz. Now he comes back to America, and he's trying to figure out a budget that actually hurts people, takes food off their table, while at the same time backing up the banks to get more tax cuts and government, when it's totally backwards from the way the Constitution is supposed to be handled.
Well, it's totally backwards from any notion of human decency.
Right, but the general welfare, that's in the preamble to the Constitution. If you look at what the Republicans are doing, they're doing it says we the people in order to form a more perfect union, not we the corporations
in order to increase our profits.
Yeah, in order to increase our profits or bust up the union.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so when you talk about how the insiders are playing this game, I'm sure you're more of a scholar than I am. Who was the president that said our constitution, our country will not be destroyed from the outside, but from within?
I don't know. I remember the quote. In fact, I think it was on the cover of None Dare Call It Treason. So it might have been.
It might have been Lincoln. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was 100 years or more ago. But yeah.
Right. But there's a great president that said, you know, our union is strong to this and that. And if it does fail, it would not have failed because of, you know, any enemy from.
Well, the stuff I was reading you last week where Henry Wallace, Vice President of the United States, FDR's vice president from 40 to 44. Henry Wallace was writing in the New York Times about how the fascists we have to worry about. And this was while we were at war with Germany. He said the fascists we have to worry about in the United States are not the people who have aligned themselves with Germany or who show up for the Bund meetings and wear swastikas and do the goose step. The fascists we have to worry about in America are the big industrialists who are putting profit ahead of community and ahead of country. That's astounding.
Which reminds me, Tom, this will be my last point. There is a very prominent family that was actually doing business with the Nazis as we went into World War II.
Okay, you're talking about the Walker Bush family.
Exactly.
Brown Brothers Harriman. Yeah, George
Prescott Bush.
Prescott Bush, yeah, thank you. Prescott Bush nearly went to jail and got censured for that. And yeah.
Right.
I believe he was censured.
Right. And so when you look at how they keep trying to connect 9/11 to the persecution and execution of over 1 million Iraqi civilians.
Right.
People do not understand. 1 million Iraqi civilians lost their lives in addition to the 5,000 troops and the almost 60,000 who are wounded or maimed for life that they don't want to take care of now.
Right.
This is all perpetrated by two men who I'm sorry, I'm not a truther, but I'm going to tell you right now. There is no connection between the 15 Saudi Arabians who hijacked those airplanes and the taxi cab drivers in Iraq who were tortured. There's absolutely no connection.
You're right.
We knew as early as December of 2001 that Osama bin Laden had went over the hills of Tora Bora into Pakistan. Okay, there is nothing that a poppy farmer in Afghanistan could tell you other than what we didn't already know.
Yep.
Okay, all that was just a sham.
Well, that's why 6 out of 7 of the people who were ever put in Guantanamo have already been released with no charges whatsoever. It was oops.
Right. In the meantime, people talk about the national debt being the way it is. We need to remind people that the wars were fought off the books. And right. So we didn't know how much money was being spent.
$1 trillion for Iraq, $1 trillion for Afghanistan, $2 trillion for the recession, $2 trillion for the tax, for the Bush tax cuts. It all adds up. Kurt, thanks a lot for the call, and to everybody else on hold. We'll get to your stuff tomorrow, your calls tomorrow. My apologies. We're out of time. But it's a beautiful, beautiful day here in Washington, D.C. Hopefully the beginning of a great week and a fascinating one. A lot going on. The Senate's still in session, so be sure and tune in tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you to show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.